Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to this edition of News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. For all but two of the last 30 years, Congressman David Price has served the Triangle region in Washington. During that time, he has earned a reputation as a sober and steady player who focuses on things like making the budget process work rather than taking lots of controversial or high-profile stands. Over the last year, however, with the rise of Donald Trump, Price has become increasingly blunt and outspoken about what he sees as some grave threats to the well-being of Americans and our democracy. I talked with the congressman earlier this week about some of these issues. In part one of our interview, we focused on the gun violence crisis that's come to the fore in the aftermath of the tragic mass shooting at a Florida high school. Congressman David Price, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be with you.
Well, the news in the country these days is not very happy in a lot of ways. We've had a dreadful event last week with respect to the horrific shooting in Florida at the school in Parkland. You've been obviously a leader and a champion for sane gun policy for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit more about your initial reactions to this tragedy?
My reaction was, it was just horrible. This is one of the worst. No killing of this kind is remotely acceptable, but we seem to be hardened to this, or at least our political system is hardened. But this may be different. I mean, I think the circumstances here and these teenagers, these remarkable high school students going out to the community and expressing their anguish, but also their anger and their expectation that surely somebody will do something. I think that's powerful. I'm hopeful that it'll enable us to make some breakthroughs here. We have in the past always had this dreary repetition of the thoughts and prayers being offered on the House floor, but absolutely nothing being done, and the NRA, the gun lobby, having a hammerlock on our political system. That really, really needs to change. I'm hopeful, ever hopeful, that that we can break through. We're certainly going to try.
I myself got a chance to attend a student-led rally in Raleigh the other night, and I too was sort of struck by it felt a little different this time, that obviously maybe I'm being naive and overly optimistic, but I don't remember this kind of just spontaneous outrage that's truly coming from the people, not just from advocacy organizations, and it felt a little different this time. Maybe we're starting to see a few cracks in the, as you describe it, hammerlock that the NRA has on our political system.
Yeah, I was there as well, and as each of 17 students lit a candle for the victims and started marching down Hillsborough Street, I'm hopeful too. We all know there's no solution that makes this sort of thing totally addresses the problem, but goodness knows we can do some common sense things, and I would start with getting these weapons of mass killing off the street. They have no place in civilian society. And then, of course, tightening up the background checks so that people with serious mental illness or violent backgrounds don't get any weapons. And then there is one idea that's come to the fore that I think is very promising that we haven't really thoroughly debated, and that is the idea of a gun violence restraining order. A couple of states have done this. The notion that law enforcement might be able to deal with someone who's threatening or menacing and who has weapons and shouldn't have weapons, they just take those weapons away. Like there is a domestic violence restraining order. There could be a gun violence restraining order that identifies people. I think of this shooter who killed these three Muslim students here in Chapel Hill 3 years ago. People knew he was menacing and threatening. He had an apartment full of weapons. He was threatening the community. There ought to be some way to get at such persons before they commit awful crimes.
It would seem to make sense to have a mechanism to come before a judge who could hear the evidence. It's not as if it would be any kind of an arbitrary act, but the judge would actually hear the evidence as they do now for standard domestic violence protection orders and then decide whether or not it was proper for the state to act.
That's right. California and I think one other state have such a system. And Representative Marsha Morey has introduced a measure to that effect in the General Assembly.
Obviously, you have no desire to take away firearms from law-abiding citizens, but we clearly have to draw the line somewhere. We can't have Americans walking around with machine guns and bazookas and flamethrowers. And I mean, that seems to at least be some consensus on that. Where do we draw the line? I mean, is it with the machine gun-like assault weapons?
Well, I think we certainly draw a line at the machine gun-type assault weapons and the high-capacity magazines. There's no legitimate sporting or hunting purpose of those weapons. Those are weapons of mass killing, and they shouldn't be in civilian society. I really think that is fundamental, and so many of these mass shootings do involve these sorts of weapons. They turn what would be an awful single killing into a multiple killing, a mass killing. It does seem to me that is fundamental, as well as the background check system. We do have a way of checking on people who have domestic violence in their history, who have criminal backgrounds, who have serious mental illness. But only 50% of the guns transferred are subject to that. You know, you can go out to a gun show and not worry about that, or internet sales. And one of the problems in Florida apparently was that this young man had serious mental health issues, but he wasn't entered in the system, so there was no safeguard. The system isn't much good unless it's airtight and unless the right information is entered into the system.
President Trump, somewhat surprisingly at least, seemed to indicate some support for the idea of regulating these so-called bump stocks. Are you at all encouraged by that?
It's something at least, and it's related to the Las Vegas tragedy. The shooter there didn't have an outright assault weapon. He had a bump stock, which transformed another weapon. And yes, of course, that would be a step forward, but a very, very tiny step. One hopes that the president's serious about this and not going to have whatever he's willing to do vetted by the gun lobby.
I believe there's a provision in the president's budget about banning the Center for Disease Control funding for gun safety research. Am I right about that?
Yes, absolutely. You're right. And it's been added for years by the Congress. So the president this time just put it in his own budget, which is ridiculous. We do research at the Center for Disease Control on all kinds of situations that result in human injury and death. We research accidents. We research all kinds of things that put people at peril. And so understanding the circumstances of gun violence, the kinds of things that might deter or prevent gun violence, this is perfectly within the purview. There wasn't any question, I think, the motivation years ago when Jay Dickey, Representative Dickey, put that in a House Appropriations bill that this kind of study would be forbidden. Jay Dickey later repented of that. He's now deceased, but he said he wasn't meaning to shut down all research on gun violence, but that's, of course, what happened. Now the president himself has put it in his budget.
What are they trying to accomplish with this? Is the notion that just anything that might lead to someone suggesting that we need to restrict guns in any way is what the NRA is concerned about there?
I think that's right. I mean, how else can you interpret it? Why would you fence off a legitimate area of research that could save lives unless you're just kowtowing to the gun lobby and their ideology, of course, that the right of an individual to have any kind of weapon he desires is paramount and trumps everything else. It doesn't make sense. And I'm on the Appropriations Committee, and I for years tried to remove that so-called Dickey Amendment from our appropriations bills. And we will try again, believe me. But usually it's been added from the congressional side, left it to Mr. Trump, I guess, to propose it on his own.
One last gun question, which has come up here in North Carolina, is this notion of arming teachers. My wife is a former school teacher who was telling me the other day, she was preparing to write a letter to the editor about how crazy this idea was. But I said, oh, honey, don't worry about it too much. But then I read in the paper that it's actually being discussed by our state lawmakers, at least at some level. I wonder if you have any reaction to this idea.
I think it's a terrible idea. I believe when the state lawmakers, as they say, are going to have a discussion of this and other ideas, I believe there will be plenty of evidence that this is not the way to go. We do need better security at schools. We need law enforcement presence in some cases. We need security officers in some cases. I mean, when you think about the mental illness side of this, which is, of course, an important aspect, although I think a lot of people use it to kind of hide behind and avoid facing the gun aspect and the fact, you know, every country in the world has lots of people in distress with anger and all the rest, but they don't turn into mass killers. The easy access to these weapons is the American feature that I believe needs to be the heart of the matter. But no question, we have defunded and, I think, de-emphasized mental health to this country's detriment. The kind of presence we should have for nurses and people with mental health training in the schools and the kind of things we ought to be able to do to deal with troubled young people and get their problems dealt with as early as possible. Of course we need to do that. And the schools would be the setting for that. But I don't see any evidence that this country or this state is willing to make this kind of investment. But that's the sort of thing that would really make a difference.
I want to talk about a few other matters not directly related to the gun problem. One is this issue of Russian involvement and interference in American politics. We're already seeing reports, perhaps, that Russian internet intruders have already inserted themselves into the gun debate. But we know for a fact, of course, that they were attempting to interfere in the election process in 2016. And this happened apparently even here in North Carolina. President Trump claims he's been tough on Russia, but I would trust you might disagree with that.
I would certainly disagree with it. In fact, his treatment of Putin, I think of all the people he's trashed and condemned in his tweets and in his tirades, never a cross word about Putin. There's something strange about that. There's some reason that he pulls his punches with Putin and with Russia in a very strange way. And, of course, as this evidence mounts, he continues to deny it. And always think this is about him. This is about him and his election and his legitimacy. And so he says, he's exonerated, and of course there's no such thing. But I must say, I too have been just astounded by the extent of this. Had no idea. We early on knew about the hacking, knew about the mischievous activity with respect to Podesta's emails and other things. Then we began to learn about rallies that they were infiltrating and were helping organize, and on and on. And so I think Mr. Mueller's done us a real service with these indictments. Of course, these guys will never see a day in U.S. court, probably, but it does document beyond any doubt not only that this intrusion went on, but that it was very widespread, very pervasive. That, of course, is grist for the mill in terms of what the Trump campaign might or might not have done in relation to this activity. But then you see how the U.S., just like European countries, is subject to a massive Russian interference in political processes. And we have such a decentralized electoral system, and we're just sitting ducks, I'm afraid. And so we're going to have to mount a counter effort here, even for the 2018 elections, or especially for the 2018 elections. And it would help if the president and the administration were on board with this, or were taking the lead on it, instead of just dismissing it or minimizing it.
I appreciate you keeping the faith on that one. But it's obviously far from the only matter in which the Trump administration has been advancing sort of a worrisome vision for our country. The new budget really, we've already talked about one aspect of it, but it really decimates a lot of vital public structures. I know we could spend all day on this. Are there any particular parts of the budget that really concern you the most?
Well, let me just stress one part, which is one that President Trump himself said he champions, and that is the infrastructure. I'm the ranking Democrat on the Transportation and Housing Subcommittee, and we've waited for a year now for this infrastructure initiative. And it's like the people doing the infrastructure initiative and the people doing the budget never talk to each other, because the president's budget cuts out community development block grants, cuts out new starts for transit, totally, all over the country, not a single new start for a transit system. Cuts out Tiger grants, the grants that are building Union Station in Raleigh and other great projects. And then, of course, way beyond the transportation budget, it's a very strange, well, Amtrak is radically cut. The home program, the home ownership, radically cut. So it's like the infrastructure folks never talk to the budget folks. We, I think, will be able to repair this budget. We now do have a budget agreement. The Republican chairman of my committee is on board with restoring a lot of the efforts that Trump wants to cut. So we'll see. These next couple of weeks are going to be critical as we try to, and we're still talking the 2018 budget. The 2019 budget is more of the same. We'll deal with that in due course. But we, in the meantime, have to make sure that in 2018 we do right by our investments, and then in 2019 we hopefully do better. I mean, that's the promise, and I think we'll try from the congressional side to do what the president has left undone.
Another area of real concern, of course, is the debate over immigrants and refugees, the DACA kids, the folks with temporary protected status. Not seeing a lot of hopeful signs on that. Do you have any thoughts or updates for us on where that debate stands?
That's one of the most incredible dilemmas that we face. Maybe the most the worst, well, gun violence, of course, is right up there, too. But if you're looking for evidence of congressional dysfunction, how even on issues where 80% of the population agrees, we just don't seem to be able to act. And in this case, it's particularly egregious. A lot of it here, too, lies at the feet of the president. You know, President Obama tried to get the the Dreamer legislation passed. It was filibustered by Republicans in the Senate. So he did the protective order for these young people who were brought here as children and really don't know any other country. President Trump comes in and cancels that order but says he wants Congress to fix it. Then John McCain and Dick Durbin bring him a fix, and he blows that up. And all reports are that as the Senate struggled last week to come up with a bipartisan fix, he rejected all of those things. He wants his wall down on the border. He wants to do away with most family reunification in terms of immigration policy, things that are just not acceptable. I think we're willing to make some sort of adjustment on this, but we really need the president's cooperation. And as long as he is revving up the right wing, it's not a small group. A lot of people are very afraid of this issue. But Paul Ryan, our speaker, needs to put on the floor a bipartisan compromise on this, and he won't get every Republican vote. But with Democrats and Republicans, we need to find a way through this. So far, that is not happening. I've said all along, it's hard to believe that we would let these young people be vulnerable with the expiration of their protection in March. But right now, I'm not sure what the path forward is going to be.
Well, one final broader question, I guess, really is about, you've been in this battle for a long time, Congressman. How do you stay engaged? How do you stay passionate? And what message would you deliver to people who are feeling a little discouraged right now?
I think just the range of things we've talked to and the extent to which they bring forth my passion and yours, and I hope people who are listening, I mean, that answers the question. I mean, yes, discouragement is inevitable sometimes, but discouragement is not enough. People really do need to engage, to pay attention, and to figure out ways to be active, like those young people on the streets of Raleigh this week. Every town meeting I've had this past year has been full and energetic and passionate. So we really are operating on a number of fronts, and you have to choose your battles, but it's important to have those battles. And I believe this election year is going to provide a focal point for this and enable us to erect a barricade in the House of Representatives with, I would hope, a new majority, erect a barricade against this president's worst efforts. But more than that, to lay out in things like transportation and housing, these issues that are so long, I think, under-resourced and under-emphasized. You know, lay a pathway for the future, things that we can rally behind and really work our way back. We have a lot of work to do in North Carolina and the country. But I'm excited about it in the sense that I think lots of people, more people than I've ever seen, really, are passionate and are engaged.
I think you're right on that front, and I thank you so much for all your leadership in this regard, and we look forward to having maybe a slightly more hopeful and upbeat conversation the next time we do this. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Up next, a conversation with the leader of North Carolina's most important anti-poverty advocacy organization. Stay with us.